And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am excited to be connecting with Michael Klickner from the Racine Theater Guild to talk about the current production at the Guild, which is an old classic called Dial M for Murder. And this is a production that opened this past Friday. Despite Mother Nature's protest to the contrary, amidst a really fierce winter storm, Dial M for Murder did in fact open, and it continues to run this coming weekend. And Michael, is it actually the next two weekends? I forgot to look it up.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes, the next two weekends, Thursday through Sunday.
Very good. So we are going to be talking for the next few minutes with Michael Klickner, a longtime veteran of the Racine Theater Guild, who is serving as the stage director for this production. Michael Klickner, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
And tell me just briefly about opening night this past Friday. Again, it was in the midst of a pretty fierce winter storm. Was there any serious conversation about postponing the opening, or was it no matter what going to open Friday night?
You know, the Theater Guild always subscribes to the theory that the show must go on. So the show did go on. It was a smaller house. I mean, it was 160-plus people or so. But, you know, those were true diehard theater fans who came out in that weather to see the show. And the Theater Guild has always had extremely strong supporters from the community who come to see all of the shows. And, you know, and that we love them for it. So, yeah.
Very good. Tell us about how this directorial opportunity came to you. I mean, did you go to the Guild and say, please let me direct Dial M for Murder? Or was this just an opportunity presented to you? And what was behind your interest in doing it?
Well, actually, I've directed several shows for the Theater Guild now, and that started couple of years back when Doug Inson has asked me if I'd be interested. I had worked with his wife, Kim, at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. I was the TD and built all the scenery for Parkside and the Fireside in Fort Atkinson, and Kim was the costumer. And Doug just asked me, would you be interested? And I said, well, yeah, I'd be interested. And so I periodically do shows. And what normally happens is, you know, the Guild does so many shows a year that Doug can't possibly do all of them. So he has to farm a couple of them out, and he gave me a couple of choices. And, you know, I seem to be the go-to guy when it comes to murder at the Racine Theater Guild. So I said, yeah, I'd be glad to do Dial M for Murder. So here I am. I did it.
Very good. This is actually a title that I know a whole lot more than the story itself. I've never seen the classic film by Alfred Hitchcock, although reading through the plot makes me really want to see it, and nor have I seen the stage play. Can you remind me and our listeners about the relationship between that classic Alfred Hitchcock film and the play, and which came first, and the relationship between the two?
Well, the play came first. It was written by Frederick Knott in 1952. And he wrote the play first, and it was a play, and then Hitchcock got involved in it. And there are very many cinematic type things within the play, but and in the cinema, you can jump instantly from place to place within seconds. On stage, you can't do that so easily. So we had to draw things out and make it work. But it's basically the same old story of a man who is tired of his life and thinks that his wife has been having an inappropriate affair and decides that it's time for her to go. So he arranges for her to be killed. And what happens during the play is a twist and a turn, and you learn exactly what happened. So not only do you learn it, you actually see a murder on stage with this play. So
we'll talk in a moment about some of the interesting technical challenges that this play presents to you and to your cast. What was your acquaintance with Dial M for Murder ahead of taking on this assignment as director of this production?
Well, I had seen the movie, just like everybody else. I mean, I'm a big Alfred Hitchcock fan, and I had seen the movie with Grace Kelly in it. And so, you know, everybody, those who know the movie immediately think of her and her being in it and her playing the role of Margot. So that's quite a challenge for the young lady in our play to try to measure up to her standards. But I think she did a pretty good job of it.
So tell us more about these two lead characters. It's really interesting the way the playwright has constructed them, this husband and wife, where things have gone so very, very wrong.
Type young woman who has...
Whoops. Sorry, Michael. Sorry. The phone dropped out there, so we didn't hear the start of your answer. So can you just restart your answer, okay?
Yes. I said that the main characters, Tony and Margot Wendis, are husband and wife. And she is a young socialite type woman who has all the money in the relationship. And he's a retired tennis player. And he's not happy that he's retired. You know, he was very popular and very well known, and he wants to be famous again and everything. But it turns out that his wife had an affair a while back, and he's still quite unhappy about that. And he decides that the only way to deal with it is to murder his wife or have his wife murdered. And so that's what happens in the play. And you see the lengths that Tony Wendis goes through to get rid of his wife, and she has no idea. She assumes that everything in their life is all peaches and roses and everything is beautiful, but he is he's quite a scary guy. The actor playing him, Mark, there are moments on stage when I just think, as a director, I've watched him and I think, you are really a very creepy person. but Mark, which is funny because Mark is such a very nice, kind young man. And the woman, Lindy, playing Margot, is also extremely nice and kind. And I mean, I've it's been a long time since I've worked with an actress who is just as sweet as she is. And she, not only did she learn all of her own lines, she helped the other actors learn their lines. And she's just a joy to work with. So,
well, as you've already touched on, this is a rather dark story in which, you know, at least one murder occurs, and it's a murder that occurs in a sense right in front of the audience. And I'm trying to remember if there's other moments of violence that play out in the story as well or not. But just talk for a moment about the challenge of bringing off something like that persuasively, and in that way, what kind of challenges this play presents to you and to your cast?
Well, whenever you do anything like a murder in a play, first of all, you're not going to murder anybody. Nobody gets killed at the Racine Theater Guild. I don't have a whole bunch of actresses standing in the wings waiting to go on the next day. But we have to make it look as real as possible. So what you have to do is very much like a dance. You have to choreograph the moves. And that's what we've done. Davidson Kane is Lesgate, who is hired to commit this murder. And Lindy Haug is the woman who is potentially murdered. And so we have to choreograph everything. She's actually, he chokes her to death or attempts to choke her to death. Or maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. You'll have to go see the show to know whether or not he succeeds. But, you know, whenever you do something like that, it's never the attacker who is in control. It's always the person being attacked on stage who controls how the movements and the things are. So they know, and we at the Theater Guild don't want anyone ever, ever to get hurt, because that would be a very bad thing. You know, theater is supposed to be the willing suspension of disbelief. We know that nobody really gets killed, but when you see it, you're thinking, that's not good. That's eerie. That's bone chilling. I don't like it. I don't like to see that. So, and there's only the one moment. The rest of it is pretty heady adult type language and things. I mean, young people in their teens would probably like it, but I think that anybody under 10 years of age would not understand what's going on. So, mm-hmm. So parents, if you're thinking of bringing your kids, you take that into account. Maybe you want them to, maybe that you don't. So,
How large a cast actually, are we talking about?
Well, there's actually five main characters, and I have two other characters. There's a small policeman's role who comes in the end, and then I have one other character who is never, ever seen. His name is Forge, and he's backstage on a microphone, and whenever there's a telephone call in or out, we see the person on stage on the phone, but we also can hear the other person on the line. We don't know who they are or what they are. They say who they are, but we never, ever see them. So it's a pretty interesting role for a young actor, and he does a great job of it. He has to do different people, so he puts on different voices. So really, all together, there's seven people total involved in the production on stage.
I can't remember if you said this. For somebody who has seen the classic Alfred Hitchcock film, are there any significant surprises with the stage play? Or by and large, does the stage play very closely reflect what one sees and experiences in the film?
It's pretty close to the film. The difference is in the film, you can jump from scene to scene instantly. In fact, you can see Tony Wendis in the film. He gets up and he goes to call his wife, and you see him waiting to use the payphone, and somebody else is in the payphone, and the time is ticking away because he told the person he hired to kill his wife he'd call at a certain time. But on stage, you don't get to see any of that. You just have to deal with whatever you're seeing right in front of you. And it's set up the same way that she goes out, the phone rings, Margot Wendis goes out to answer it because her husband's calling on the phone, and the murderer comes from behind the curtains and attempts to kill her. But on stage, you see all sides of that all at once. But on stage, you only see what's happening right in front of you right at the moment. It's close. It's very, very close. But, you know, Hitchcock is a master of suspense, so he can make things last a whole lot longer and hold your attention with music and lighting. It's more so than we can do on stage. We have to do things fairly quick.
It's as we've obviously made pretty clear, a rather dark story. Are there points of lightness, of humor, that are part of the story as well?
Oh, yeah, there are some funny moments. I mean, I can't pick them out off the top of my head, but I mean, you know, a play that was just constantly dark all the time would not be representative of life, and it wouldn't be the way life happens. Life has ebbs and flows, as everybody knows. There are times and moments when, you know, you could go to a funeral and have a happy thought and all of a sudden start laughing or chatting with your friends, but, you know, it's still a sad situation. But there are moments when you're it's lighthearted and you think everything's going to be okay, and then it turns out differently than you thought. And that's the beauty of these murder mysteries, is there's always a twist in there somehow or other. So
what have the biggest challenges been for you and the cast in terms of putting this together?
Well, as you said, as I've said, the murder itself, when we see somebody on stage gets killed. I mean, we've done that before in many different plays at the Theater Guild. In fact, I also directed another play by the same playwright, Frederick Knott, which is Wait Until Dark. And I did that last year or the year before, and that there's, you know, very similar type things going on. But you know, just as always in any play, and you've been involved in theater stuff, is memorizing lines. And there are some monologues that are very long, and for the actors to have to memorize those lines is difficult. But, you know, that's what actors do, and they know what they have to do. I never, as a director, I never say, well, lines are due on this date. What I tell them is, you know, when this show opens, you got to have your lines by then. If you don't, you're the ones who are going to look foolish, not me. So, you know, and it's true. I mean, you know that with singing. When you teach singing, you either learn the song or you don't. And if you don't know the song, well, I can't help you sing it. So, and I can't help them learn. I can't help them do the lines. But just that and the timing and to keep it interesting, you know, because there is a lot of talking. And so we try to keep it interesting and make sure that people just don't go, okay, I need to go to the lobby now and have a drink or something. But I think it moves along pretty well, and I think it's one of those plays that if you're paying attention, you'll be caught up in it, and you'll go, oh wow, I didn't know. Oh, okay, I get it now. I get it. So I think it's one of those kind of plays.
Very good. So the play again is Dial M for Murder, and it opened this past Friday, and it runs this coming weekend and the following weekend as well on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild. And you can call 262-633-4218, or you can go to the website, racinetheater.org, for ticket information. And the director of this production, Michael Klickner. Michael, remind me, how long have you been associated with the Racine Theater Guild?
Well, actually, my friend Cynthia McCrory, who is the stage manager, and I figured out that she and I both started with the Theater Guild way back when they did Summer of the 17th Doll on the High Street Theater, and that was 48 and a half years ago. So I've been involved with the Theater Guild off and on for a long time. Also interesting, both my parents were involved with the Racine Theater Guild. In fact, they met at the Theater Guild. My Uncle Raymond was involved with the Theater Guild, and my dad and his high school friend, Bob Heise, wrote the one and only original musical that Racine Theater Guild ever did called Adam Loves Eve. So Theater Guild is near and dear to my heart. I actually, when they built the new theater on Northwestern, I actually helped in the construction of that building and doing the rigging and all of that stuff. So I have been in myself personally involved with the Theater Guild for 48 and a half years.
Wow. Well, thank you for all you've given to the Guild, and thank you for your hard work on Dial M for Murder, and thank you for being my morning show guest today here on WGTD.
Well, thank you for having me.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. On two previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with best-selling author Gerard Coppell, the first time for a book called Bond of Union, Building the Erie Canal and the American Empire, the second time for an equally fascinating book called City on a Grid, How New York Became New York. This third encounter with Gerard Coppell is for a very different book, also from a page out of our own history, but a gruesome murder at sea. The book is titled Not a Gentleman's Work, The Untold Story of a Gruesome Murder at Sea and the Long Road to Truth. This is an incident which occurred back in 1896, and a thick cloud of mystery still surrounds the triple murder that occurred aboard the Herbert Fuller. And Gerard Coppell has done an astounding job of offering all kinds of illuminating insights and analysis into perhaps what occurred aboard this ship, and the mystery that surrounds exactly who was responsible for this terrible deed, and what ensued once this boat finally returned to shore. It's a fascinating story on many, many levels. And Gerard Coppell, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Great to be here.
You tell us in the acknowledgments, this book began with a footnote. Tell us briefly about the footnote in another book that led you to this journey of discovery.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing a book about Joshua Slocum, who was the first guy to sail alone around the world from 1895 to 1898. And he did that in a small boat, a 37-foot sailboat, or oyster sloop. And he came back and wrote a book about it, which became a bestseller, has been in print ever since. And it's sort of a standard, it's a classic now of in sailing literature and also in adventure literature and solitude literature. In any case, he mentions in an appendix near the end of the book how he managed to rig up his little boat to steer itself because obviously he couldn't steer the boat the whole time. And he said that, in a very, very brief aside, said that the question of self-steering was an issue at the recent trial in Boston. And, of course, he was writing in 1900, and I didn't know what he was referring to, but in one of the editions of this book, of his book, Sailing Alone Around the World is the name of the book, in one edition of his book, there's a footnote that explains what he was talking about. Then this was, and the footnote is relatively brief, but it mentions briefly what happened on this ship that Slocum was talking about. And I shifted my interest from Slocum to that subject.
I'm not surprised, although I hope the Slocum book emerges someday, because that would be a great story as well. So tell us a little bit about this ship, the Herbert Fuller. It was a relatively small vessel, and I think about a dozen people on board when it left harbor on July 8th, 1896. Tell us about the ship and what occurred a few days later.
Yeah, the Herbert Fuller was about 180-foot long barkentine, which means it had three masts. The first mast was square-rigged, and the main and mizzen masts were fore-and-aft rigged, and which is a very typical rig for the day. And they were headed from Boston to Buenos Aires in Argentina with a load of cut New England pine boards, which were loaded below decks and on deck. And there were 12 people on board, as you said, the captain, his wife, and wives often traveled with their captain husbands in those days, especially couples that didn't have any children at home, or wives that didn't have any children at home to take care of, which this couple didn't. The captain, Charles Nash, was 42, and Laura Nash was 39. Why they didn't have children, who knows. In any case, those two, the first mate, Thomas Bram, the second mate, his name, there's been a lot of questions precisely about his name, but he was August Blomberg, and he was a Russian Finn. And then there were six regular crewmen, three of whom were from Sweden, one from France, one from Germany, and one from Holland. And this was very typical in the day. This was an American registered ship, but the crew were all non-American born. The first mate, Thomas Bram, was born in the Caribbean, and August Blomberg, as I mentioned, was born in Finland. So you had six crew members, two mates, all born not in America. And you also had the cook, Jonathan Spencer. He was born also in the Caribbean. And finally, a passenger. And this is somewhat unusual in these days to have a passenger. But he had been, his space on the boat had been arranged for with the captain by his parents. And his name was Lester Hawthorne Monks, M-O-N-K-S. And he was 20 years old. He had just failed himself out of Harvard, and also drunk his way out of Harvard. And he was on the boat as a passenger, simply put there simply by his parents to clear his head for a while. They didn't want him in Boston, where he was, where the family lived. And he was something of an embarrassment to the family. And they put him on this ship and anticipated once the ship got to Argentina, he would take another ship to Europe, and then he might stick around Europe for a while and not really come home for a good while, because he'd already been enough of embarrassment to his family by getting thrown out of Harvard.
So
that's the setup.
So that tells us who was aboard this ship, an interesting mix of characters. And then at some point on July 14th, a truly gruesome murder takes place, murder with an axe. The captain, his wife, and the second mate all brutally murdered. And, of course, the question that immediately emerges is who was responsible for such a terrible deed. Just describe to our listeners, in a sense, the what ensued in the immediate wake of this horrific act of triple murder, in terms of the ship's journey back to port, and what had to be done.
Yeah, so let's backtrack a little bit. The murders are discovered at 2 o'clock in the morning by Lester Monks, the Harvard student. I should say that all of these murders took place in the aft cabin. In the aft cabin is where the captain, his wife, the first and second mates, and the passenger slept. Everybody else slept in the forward cabin. The regular crew slept in the forward cabin. At the time of the murders, 2 o'clock in the morning, there were only four people asleep in the aft cabin: captain, wife, second mate, and passenger. The other guy, the first mate, Thomas Bram, was on watch on deck. So you have four sleeping people. Three of them are killed with the axe, the ship's axe, which is stored in a room, taken from a room in the aft cabin by whoever committed these crimes. And whoever did it killed three of the people sleeping there and passed by were the fourth person, Lester Monks. Monks discovers the murders, and I'll say, let's put discovers in quotes. He comes up on deck, alerts the first mate, Thomas Bram, and eventually, as the morning progresses on the 14th of July, 1896, the rest of the crew is woken up, and everybody gathers on deck, and they know there are nine survivors. They know that amongst those nine is the one killer, and nobody knows which one it is except the guy who did it, and he's trying to hide his culpability. So it's a very nervous time. They're out in the middle of the ocean, about 8 days out, 7 days out from Boston. And and Bram, the first mate, is now the in charge of the vessel. And under his command, they decide to sail to Halifax, which is, they figured, the easiest piece of land to get to. And so they set sail for there. And a couple of days later, it appears that the guy who was steering the boat at the time, one of the crewmen who lived forward on the ship, his name was Justice Leopold Westerberg. He was one of the Swedes. He was the oldest guy on the boat, or the oldest crewman on the boat, 41 years old. And he went by the name Charlie Brown. It appeared to some of the people on board that he might have been responsible. He had been steering the boat at the time, and possibly he's the guy that might have tied off the wheel and let the boat steer itself, and that's how we got to the got from the Joshua Slocum story. Might have tied off the wheel himself, gone below into the dark cabin, found the axe, and I should note that none of the crew members, regular crew members who slept forward, ever went into the aft cabin. So he would not have known where he was down there, especially how to find an axe, and especially at night. In any case, it was thought that he was the guy who had done it, and he was chained to one of the masts, tied up and chained to one of the masts. They proceeded on their way toward Halifax, and 4 days later, day before they got to Halifax, Charlie Brown mentioned to one of the crew members that while he, Charlie Brown, had been on the wheel, he had looked through a window into the aft cabin and seen Thomas Bram, the first mate, with an axe. And all of a sudden, Thomas Bram was chained, and Thomas Bram was then commanding the ship. He was chained under the authority of the steward, Jonathan Spencer, who really sort of took over things. And Bram was chained to another mast, and a day later they got into Halifax. And there are there are some good reasons why Bram might have been chained, aside from any culpability for murders, possible culpability for murders. is that if the ship came into port without any of its officers in command, then the crew members who did that would be in line for substantial rewards. Hmm. So from their point of view, it wasn't such a bad idea to put Bram in irons.
Hmm.
In any case.
It's an incredibly dramatic scene. You tell us at some point that the Fuller murders, like the Lizzie Borden murders, which I think had just occurred, fit two related genres of fiction, the locked room mystery and the closed circle of suspects. I mean, it is the stuff of which dramatic films are made.
I hope.
Right, maybe someday. We're speaking with Gerard Capel. We're talking about his newest book, Not a Gentleman's Work, The Untold Story of a Gruesome Murder at Sea and the Long Road to Truth. So your book is not only one that sets the stage and then describes at least what we know of what occurred on that horrific night, but then about the trials, and I say trials, that ensued once everybody reached land. Do I understand correctly that that there was a time early on when basically all of the survivors aboard the Herbert Fuller were technically speaking under arrest or under a fairly serious cloud of suspicion before a very specific suspect was ultimately charged?
Definitely. When they all got to Halifax, everybody was put under arrest, including Lester Monks, although it very quickly appeared that he was different from the rest of the seafaring crew, that he was from a proper family in Boston, and he was accorded a lot of leeway by the officials in Halifax. And also when they all got back to Boston, the ship never went to Boston. It went off on other voyages, which is a strange thing. It wasn't available for the trials. And in any case, all the crew is shipped back to Boston, where it's determined that the trial will take place. This is now a trial of the first mate, Thomas Bram. Mm-hmm. The suspicion around the crewman who was the helmsman at the time, Charlie Brown, sort of evaporates. Everybody points fingers at Thomas Bram, and he is the one put on trial in federal court in Boston later in 1896. And it's in federal court because because the events happen at sea, and that automatically puts it in federal appellate court, federal circuit court. And Thomas Bram's first trial takes place in late 1896 with a jury decision very early in January.
One of the things your book does is raise the very, very real possibility that this had something to do with race. That is, the fact that suspicion was ultimately directed towards Thomas Bram rather than Lester Monks, and that this was a matter perhaps of race and also perhaps of Lester Monks coming from a very well-connected family. Let's talk about both of those matters and have you spell out how much you think those matters were important here.
Yeah, I mean, definitely race and class are at play here. Thomas Bram, who's 33 at the time, is from St. Kitts. It's a small island in the Caribbean. His mother is black. His father, it's undetermined. He was not from St. Kitts. He was from elsewhere. It's unclear exactly. And he departed soon after Thomas Bram and his two younger siblings were all born. And he might have been white. He might have been mixed. It's unclear. In any case, Bram himself was... it was very important to him in late 19th century America and into the next century that people think of him as white. He filled out all of his shipping papers as white, that in fact he claimed that he had been born in Nova Scotia, which he clearly hadn't. Although on his official documentations, on federal and state forms, he did acknowledge that he was black and from St. Kitts. However, he was relatively light-skinned, and he had a sort of weathered look from his years at sea, and he could pass as white, and passing as white was something that was not unfamiliar in those days. In fact, he married a woman who was a German-American woman who lived in Brooklyn, New York, as Bram did when he was ashore. And she did not know that he was black until she found out a number of years after their marriage. It's interesting, in all of the records, I don't see anything, any overt derogatory mentions of Bram. And, you know, his trial took place in Boston. You could certainly expect that to happen, but it didn't. And he clearly, I mean, it's apparent at the trial, and I should say that the main source of information about this case are the trial transcripts, which are in the Harvard Law Library. It's about 5,500 pages of trial transcripts of the first trial, and as we'll probably talk in a couple of minutes, the second trial. But in none of that, and in none of the newspaper coverage, of which is extensive, of course, around the country, especially in Boston, but around the country and also in Europe, there's no overt mention of Bram's race. And I found that a little bit curious. Maybe people didn't think there was a racial issue, but there clearly was. And then, of course, there's the issue of, what do we call it, class, where Lester Monks, the guy who discovered the murders, gets a very wide berth from all investigators and all lawyers at the trials, given his background. And it sets up a real almost like a Prince and Pauper situation with Monks and Bram. And Charlie Brown, the guy who was steering, you know, at the time of the murders, he is sort of, as time goes by, he becomes less of a possibility as the killer. And it really becomes, and what I do in the book is make it a real story of Bram and Monks, and I track them long after the trial to the end of each of their lives,
which I think is a really enhances the book immeasurably. Before we move on to the second trial, I want to give you a chance to talk about the level of to which this was a media sensation at the time, and it's important, I think, for us to acknowledge that, because of course now this has been a story that was all but completely lost to history. But at the time, this made headlines everywhere. Help us understand the scope of which of the interest surrounding this event and these trials.
What you mentioned, Lizzie Borden, her trial, her killings and trial were 4 years earlier, 50 miles away from Boston. So there was definitely a little bit of a continuation of that sort of media frenzy. But this case really stands out as separate. But it was, you know, entire first pages of Boston newspapers and substantial headlines, you know, everywhere else, especially in the American Northeast. You know, New York, Washington, D.C. was very big. I don't, you know, it must have something to do with the, I think it probably has something to do with the the mystery of the sea. I think readers of newspapers and consumers of of this sort of story are just fascinated by things that happen at sea. And it's a place that most people don't go. And to get a view of it through the newspaper was intriguing for many people.
Explain the legal significance of this case, in particular as we get to the second trial, because although this story is fascinating enough in and of itself, it's also important because of what it, in a sense, ultimately creates in terms of our legal system.
Right. So Bram is convicted at the first trial in a three-week trial. There are all kinds of issues with the trial, but we don't need to go into that now. Especially the way the jury finally reaches verdict, they took many, many votes and were split 9-3 in favor of conviction. And then finally the other three gave in, and one of them said, you know, may God protect him for doing it. In those days, in a murder trial, the only penalty available was death. So Bram was sentenced to death, and which is going to take place in June of 1897. He had two very good court-appointed lawyers, two very prominent lawyers of Boston who believed then and always did believe for the rest of their lives that Bram was not guilty. They appealed to the next court, the next appellate court after Federal Circuit Court, and that is the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court reversed Bram's conviction, saying that, basing it on the Fifth Amendment, as the first time the U.S. Supreme Court had made a decision based on the Fifth Amendment, which says, among other things, that person shall not be compelled in a criminal case to be a witness against himself. And what they based that on was that when the crew all got back to Halifax, a local detective had questioned Bram while Bram was shackled and naked. I've never been quite sure what is meant in all the materials by naked. I'm not sure if he's actually physically completely naked or maybe just stripped down to his pants or something like that. In any case, he's questioned by a local detective who says, listen, Bram, Charlie Brown says he saw you through that window. What do you make of it? And Bram says, how could he possibly have seen me through that window? Meaning it was dark, and the positioning of the window from where Charlie Brown was steering at the wheel could not have given him a view of what was going on there. So that's a curious statement. He couldn't have seen me. But then the detective continues and says, listen, we think you did it, but we think you must have had help with this. You couldn't have possibly done this alone. And Bram says, well, I think Charlie Brown did it. I didn't do it, and that's all I have to say about it. And this detective testified at the first trial, and that's what the U.S. Supreme Court had a problem with, that was effectively a denial on his part, on Bram's part, but that in any case he should not have been compelled to have given that information to the Halifax detective. And so they reverse and they send it back for a new trial. And it should be noted that this being the first time the U.S. Supreme Court has made a decision based on the Fifth Amendment, it leads ultimately 70 years later to the famous Miranda warning, the Miranda case, which says, of course, you have a right to remain silent. And it's a long journey from U.S. versus Bram to the Miranda case. But the Miranda case does start with the decision in the Bram case by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Hmm. A last quick question. One of the most interesting mysteries surrounding this was rumors that circulated for a time that Lester Monks, who I believe you regard as the strongest or most likely suspect in these murders, had given a deathbed confession to having committed the murders. And the mystery surrounding whether or not this ever happened just kind of speaks to the ongoing interest at the time in this whole case.
Yeah. There is, in 1921, rises a rumor that Monks had made a deathbed confession. And then when he, which is not sustained, and then in 1927, after he dies, 6 years after that, a prominent Boston attorney, one of the most prominent Boston attorneys, writes a letter to the Harvard law librarian. It's because at this point the trial transcripts have arrived at the Harvard law library. Anyway, this prominent Boston lawyer says to the Harvard law librarian, listen, by the way, I thought you might like to know, since you've gotten the trial transcripts, that that on his deathbed, Lester Monk said that he did it. And, of course, you know, what do you do with that? It's long after Monks is dead. It's a third party making this statement, and it would be challenged by the Monk's family doctor, who was supposedly the person who took this acknowledgement.
Just one more fascinating wrinkle in a very, very compelling story told so well in your book, Not a Gentleman's Work, The Untold Story of a Gruesome Murder at Sea and the Long Road to Truth. The author, Gerard Capel. Gerard Capel, thank you for giving the world yet another fascinating book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was great to talk with you again.
Thank you so much, Greg.